Welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. Sitting on my desk, I'm going to tell you what lies ahead. Sitting on my desk are a couple of books. One's ingeniously entitled The Fog of Peace, and it brings back memories of talking to Robert McNamara about his fog of war. It's written, co-authored by Juan Domenico Pico and Gabriel Rifkind, and Juan Domenico will be joining me shortly. The other book is a little older, but it's a powerful piece of writing. It has the following title: The Man Without a Gun, One Diplomat's Secret Struggle to Free the Hostages, Fight Terrorism and End a War. And if that sounds a bit over the top, it's entirely justified, because my guest worked for the UN for 20 years, was a negotiator in the Geneva Agreements on the withdrawal of the Soviet troops from Afghanistan, the ceasefire between Iran and Iraq, the freeing of American and UK hostages in Lebanon, and the return of Israeli soldiers missing in action in Lebanon. For this and other reasons, he received the US President's Special Award for Exceptional Service. And he joins us tonight to discuss what we're going to call, with justification, the hostage business. Also with us, you'll meet Susan Dabou, an Italian citizen of Syrian-Italian background, who's written How Would You Like to Die? The Diary of a Kidnapping in Syria. And this describes what happened when she, in fact, became a hostage. So coming up, the hostage business, and then an abrupt and absolute change of gear and tempo. We're going to be discussing the impact of the internet on aspects of sexual intercourse, particularly prostitution and pornography. As matters in the Middle East spiral further out of control, and if you were listening to the news, as I was, we're back into mission creep. Of course, this has been exacerbated by last week's murder of James Foley and the threat of further retribution by IS. But a good story emerged yesterday, the release of another very lucky American journalist, Peter Curtis. Peter's release is particularly interesting because it was negotiated quietly, out of the media spotlight, by American newspaper executive David Bradley and a former unnamed FBI agent who was known for his extensive contacts on the ground. And therein lies the rub. The detailed knowledge of those involved in the murky area of hostage taking and the skills a negotiator has to have to work successfully where lives hang in the balance. So we couldn't get two better credentialed people to discuss matters arising. Gianni is talking to us on Skype, I understand. And we also have Susan Dabou, who's online. And I'm not... Hang on, let me just check. Yes, both of them, I think, are in Connecticut. Okay, let's get started with you, Gianni. First of all, thank you very much for your time. Would you set the scene for us by taking us back to 1990 and that night in Beirut when you got into a car blindfolded?
Well, thank you very much for having me. Let me just tell you that I'm a great believer that every day is different from the day before. And that means that even history moves on, and that what happened and how it was done 20 years ago cannot be done today, because history has moved on. It's not the same. More specifically, during the Cold War, we had very, very few variables. We, meaning those who were negotiating at every level between states, the number of variables was very, very few. And therefore, it was easier to negotiate during the Cold War. Afterwards, it became more difficult, because everybody seemed to be the king of the world, and everybody has its own ways. So that's the difference. In terms of what happened to me, of course, the story of the Western hostages in Lebanon, which included not only British and Americans, as you mentioned, but also Germans, which are not always very mentioned. The case of the course of the Lebanese situation was a manifestation of a period in history when, of course, it was the first coming to of age of the Iranian revolutionary state, namely Iran, and of course the connection with Iran and what was happening in Lebanon, where a very significant group also of Shia beliefs was operating, namely Hezbollah, or was just starting, in fact. That was really the basis of the operation. Now, the negotiation for those hostages, which were many, were for a long time, as you know, for many years, some for 7 years. That had three stages. The first stage was that there was a negotiation I had directly with the president of Iran, which took a long time to set up. And there was a second stage, which was a negotiation with the very hostage takers. And in order to negotiate for them, I realized this only the very last minute, they wanted to take me hostage. And that's what happened a number of times, not only once. And I was blindfolded and locked up in cars, taken away, and I had no idea where I was. And the third negotiation was a negotiation with Israeli intelligence, which was involved as well, in a sense that one of the requests of the kidnappers was that a number of people taken by Israel also be released. And that negotiation was also conducted by yours truly. And so there were three sets of negotiations that lasted a long time, in a way. But it was... I had learned by then that you do not negotiate with countries, you negotiate with individuals.
One of those individuals in 1990 held your hand in the car. I find this an extraordinary image. What was its significance?
Well, that was one of the, as I said, I was taken four times. So in one of the occasions, the unexpected situation was that they were in a very bad tension with the Syrian intelligence. So they were doing everything possible to make sure the Syrian intelligence would not get the benefit of any release of hostages in that particular moment. And so he decided, for some reason which I do not know, that when they released me, he would also sit in the car with me. I suppose the purpose was to make sure that I was not being interfered by Syrian security, which, as you know, by the time during the last part of the fighting in Lebanon was quite active in Beirut. And so he sat down with me, and I do not know what happened in his mind, but yes, he was sitting on the back. I was surprised. It was the first and only time it happened. And he did, basically... hold my hand and said, good luck, something of the sort.
This is LNL on RN, and we're discussing the hostage business with Juan Domenico Pico in Connecticut. And before we go to Susan, who's in Jerusalem, I now learn, I want to ask you about the fog of war. Of course, that was about Vietnam, about the things that were not, in fact, clearly discussed or well understood at the time by McNamara or the administration. I suppose it was about the US not understanding the mind of its enemy, and that's central to so much of your work, Gianni, isn't it, to understand your enemy?
Yes, absolutely. And there are two levels there, to be in one word. There is the national narrative, and there is the individual narrative. Anybody who says to you, how do you negotiate with Iran, and can tell you, to negotiate with Iran, you have to do so and so. I know exactly that it's never done in a negotiation. You don't negotiate with countries. I had the fortune, quote unquote, of negotiating with subsequent presidents of Iran. And if I negotiated with one in the same way I did with the other, at least in one case, I would have failed. But I was lucky and I succeeded in both cases. So you have to understand that the national narrative, in my view, try to understand, because we never do, and to the extent possible to understand the individual narrative.
Susan, it's time for your narrative now, and I want you to tell us what was happening what happened when you were filming for Italian television, the desecration of a Christian church.
Yeah, I've been kidnapped with a RAI team, the Italian national TV, in a small village close to Latakia, in a small Christian village in Syria. So the problem in our case was that they were not happy of what we were filming. And because we arrived in the village early in the morning and we crossed illegally the border from Syria the day before, so they were not planning to kidnap us. Like other cases of kidnapping, more classical cases of kidnapping, like people kept in Syria, in northern Aleppo, or close to the Turkish border. So in our case, they were surprised by our presence, and they were so upset by the fact that we were an Italian TV, and they told that filming a desecrated church had a political meaning for the Vatican. So they assumed that the local priest called the Vatican, the Vatican called the RAI, and the RAI sent us to film this. And it wasn't the case. I mean, we were there filming the life of the civilians after the first 2 years of war.
It's interesting that there were about 30 of them in the brigade, and you worked out that they'd come from North African countries like Tunisia, Morocco, Libya, Egypt, but there are also Caucasians and Afghans.
Yes, I mean, in my case, it was particularly difficult to look their faces because I was always covered by a blanket used as a burqa, because they were extremists. So I was always covered, and also they were covered, but I could see the difference between white jihadis, so they were from East Europe, of course, or Russians, but they were also Africans. And I remember, for example, one jihadi who had a very strong North American accent, so I couldn't see his face, but I understood, I mean, I learned from his accent that he was from Canada or Northern America.
You talk about them as going to war like we go to work. I think that's a fascinating phrase.
Thank you. I was trying to see them as a human beings, because I was sure that I was going to be held for a long time, for years maybe, because I heard other cases at that time of other hostages. And also the fact that I was a woman and I was half Syrian, and I did ask to be converted to Islam in order to be respected physically. I mean, this put me in a different situation compared to my Italian colleagues. So I was ready to be with them, and I wanted to understand their society. So I spent 4 days with a woman. She was the wife of one of the jihadists who came from Tunisia. And I tried to understand their mentality, their ideology, and she was completely used to violence. She was used to bombardment. So the first night we slept together, I was terrified by the shellings because they were particularly close, and she was absolutely used. I mean, she got used to this, and also the fact that close to the house where we were, the jihadis, the mujahideen, were having their training every day, so they were shouting and screaming, and all this to her was normal, and her husband was used to come at home to have a rest, to have snack, to sometimes also to have sex. So this was their daily life, and I was lucky enough to look at them and to write about it and to survive.
This is Ellie Nell on RN, and we're discussing the hostage business with Gianna Pico and Susan Dabu. Gianni, another thing that strikes a really deep emotional chord in the new book, The Fog of Peace, is you talk about how some of the Hamas in Lebanon still wear the keys to their houses in Jaffa and Haifa from 1948. So there's a narrative, isn't there?
Indeed. Indeed. That's why history is a very personal matter. It is not really the general history that appears for sake of convenience, and of course for the only possibility in books. So yes, there is a story of each of us in different ways, and I think that's why every case is cannot be just repeated, as no life can be repeated. And I think it was evident, of course, that in my history, I spent decades interfering more, I would say is the word, more with the Shia than with the Sunnis. But nevertheless, it was evident that after a few years, what came to my mind was that when you are in minority, you get smarter. And forget not that the Shia have been in minority in the Arab Sea for a long time, at least from the time they lost Baghdad to the Sultan in 1534, date which they still remember in daily conversations. So that it was another aspect because, you know, I'm a minority myself. So that was, in a way, was interesting. Not that I discovered it earlier, I discovered it later. And so there was a kind of communication of a different kind. And it did emerge in my discussion over decades with different situations that when you are in minority, you have to get smarter. And that is why, in a way, this is a generic thing. The terrorists who come from minority groups are usually smarter,
yeah.
Which is not a good thing to say, but that's what it is.
I just admired that phrase of Suzanne's, going to war like we go to work. There's a phrase of yours which I found compelling. You talk about imaging the future. Tell me what that means. Imagining the future. Sorry, Joni.
Oh, to me? Yes. I think the future has to do with our hopes. And our hopes have to do with the ability we have to build what happens tomorrow. And in a way, minorities had to be, so to speak, smart and more adept to the situation to create a world which was more suitable to them. And so that is, you know, it's something that comes out. The question, the first one, or the first question that Imam Mughni, the number two to Hezbollah, mentioned to me the first time he took me. I say his name because according to Israeli intelligence, he was the one who actually got me. And he asked me, and he said, why do you risk your life for somebody who is not a member of your tribe?
It's a good question. What was your answer?
My question was, the answer was complicated because apart from being, of course, having been taken and having in front of me people not sitting in a diplomatic environment, so to speak, and I was left with just a shirt and underwear after they went through everything. My answer was, I have to answer to him in something which makes sense, but also in something that enters his narrative. And so I said, this is a risk because I do not know. They don't teach you in courses of negotiation at Harvard University how you answer these questions. And so my answer was, I like to pay forward. So I realized immediately that he had this confused him and said, what the hell are you saying? What do you mean to pay forward? And I said, look, 10 years ago, what was the chance that you and I would meet? Probably 0000 something. So, you know, I have the same thought that perhaps 20 years from now, my son and your son will meet. And your son will have in his hand the chance to save my life's son. And then he exploded in a way. And I said, my God, this is finished. I'm finished. He said, why, how do you know that I have a son? First mistake I made. And then I said, well, I guessed. And then he said, okay, but what does it mean to pay forward? And I said, you see, if 20 years from now, your son will have a chance to save the life of my son, I'd like to pay now for that. And then he said, where the hell do you come from?
It's a fair comment. I mean, what you're saying is so extraordinarily poetic. In a situation where one would have thought it was, the time for verbal specificity.
Yeah, but it was actually what I'm saying. The negotiation is really between individuals. You know, it's not
absolutely,
really.
Absolutely. Now, that's it's a very compelling scene. Now, back to you, if I can, Susan. You're imagining the future. You, I guess, couldn't really imagine a future when you were under a blanket.
Actually, I was very concentrated to preserve myself. And physically, first of all, it was important because we have been imprisoned in a very bad, abandoned house. And also, I was trying to preserve myself from, I don't know, kind of very bad thoughts. The first bad thoughts were about the fact that they could harass me, and they could rape me. And this was the first, because I was surrounded by 30 or 40 fighters, and I was the only woman, so this was very scary. And I was not thinking about the future, really. I was thinking about survival. And the future, I thought that, for example, one night I had the occasion to escape, and I didn't, because I thought that that was not a movie, that was real life. And I mean, to win in that terrible situation in which I was completely submitted, it was to be alive. So I thought that it was better not to escape, to stay with them, even for 5 or 10 years. And if they would release me after 10 years, at that time, I was the winner.
Yeah,
I would won. Because this was my
Is that how you feel now, that you are the winner? Do you feel that?
Yes, I think I'm the winner because I gain a second life, and this is the most important. Somehow they are happy with their decision because I could see them from close, and they are not concerned about anything. I mean, the fact that they have the culture of martyrdom, or the fact that they are not scared about death. I mean, this makes them particularly not concerned about anything. So unburdenable. So they think they are the winner, and somehow they are the winner, but they are the winner in a terrible life. I mean, the life they do is just terrible. I mean, it's life of violence, and even if they choose that violence because they enjoy the violence, but in the same time, I don't think that they have any space for real love.
We're calling this the hostage business, and I want to address that as an issue, Joni, because it is business. It's big business. I learn from you that we're talking about ransoms that run well over $100 million.
Yes. However, I think that the origin of the whole thing it's not necessarily business in that sense. It is really power. And that I first learned is actually I was the first Westerner to enter Kabul after the Soviets in 1979 or 80. But anyway, it is much to do also with the evolution. The entire Levant, which is the land I walked through from Pakistan to Lebanon in my decades, is really changing dramatically from what it was when we invented it, or rather when it was invented after World War I. And this is what we are witnessing now. We are really witnessing a profound, in a way, civilizational change of a region, looking for something, different structures. And that's what is going on now for the last several years. And that's why at the end of the day, the bottom line is, when 3 years ago, I wrote probably for the first time, and only a British paper published it, we are not speaking about Syrian civil war. We are speaking about a third chess game between Iran and Saudi Arabia in 30 years, and that has became to be proven.
Gianni, you understand this very clearly, but I wonder whether your UN employers understood it. I wonder whether Washington, D.C. ever understood the complexities and the paradox and the almost the Rubik cube complexities.
Well, two things in brief. First of all, the question of war and peace is something that for which the UN was built after World War II, but it was built within a context of the Cold War. When the Cold War ended, the ability of the UN to solve conflicts ended. In fact, since 1992, the UN, or rather multilateralism, has solved nothing in terms of conflicts. And that is because the structure was built on the concept of the Cold War, which was a much easier world, very few variables, as I said. So that in that context, the UN, in conflict resolution only, has been overtaken by history. And what we have now is a different situation. And that's why the UN cannot work in that way. It has always been the conflicts of the last 20 years have only been resolved by bilateralism or minilateralism. And that is what it is. This is just a moving forward of history. Nothing else. Nobody's guilty. Just it moves on. We have to understand what happens. You know, there are there are those who still believe and use, when you speak about negotiation, they use the term impartiality. Anybody who tells you impartiality has never done negotiation, because impartiality does not exist. Does not exist. If you put a glass in the middle of the table, you are on one side or the other, I will always see the glass closer to you and vice versa. Anybody who wants to be impartial is not a conflict resolution person or a negotiator who can solve the problem, because he doesn't get it.
Yeah. There is one player in all of this who does seem to be, or claims to be, sort of impartial, and that's Qatar, the go-to place for negotiations these days, I'm told.
No. Qatar doesn't want to be impartial. Qatar is engaged in a, for the last several years, in a kind of a duel, so to speak, with their neighbors, the Saudi royal house. And that's what it is. It's not really impartial. Nobody wants to be impartial, because nobody can be, especially within the frame of mind of the reality in the Gulf. No. But Qatar is very influential, because they know how to use the instruments they have, which is money, and also, I think, a very good understanding of a number of countries in the West.
I brought them into the discussion because they apparently played a significant role in the behind-the-scenes negotiations for the release of Peter Curtis.
Indeed, and they are doing even more. And you will see more results brought about by Qatar. But that's not exactly, but that is nothing to do with impartiality. It has to do with the fact that Qatar has been playing a very small country, but very rich. Has been playing a very interesting role from the time of the Libyan affairs to what is going on now in the Syrian-Iraqi space, as I call it, instead of calling two different countries, which probably is more correct. And I think they're very useful and very nimble.
I wonder whether private companies are operating in this murky world of hostage negotiation.
My answer would be, it would depend of who is the person involved. It's not much to do with the company per se, but with the individuals involved. I mean, institutions of all nature, private or public, find themselves in a world which is changing, namely where the individuals is becoming more stronger than institutions, simply because of technology and the economics of the world today. So it's a moving world, so to speak, where you cannot use the same same structure or the same pages you used 15 years ago, or 20 or even 25.
Syria is an example of where things get impossibly complex, and this is back to you, Susan. 130,000 dead, more than 6 million people displaced. What's your own view of what's been going on in Syria pre- and post-war?
So before the war, the Syrian civil society was following the Arab uprising, like the Arab Spring, and it began exactly like in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, with the difference that, I mean, the Syrian regime is very different to the other Arab regime. First of all, because it's held by a minority, so it's a religious and ethnic minority, and this means that they fight for survival. I mean, if the Assad regime gave up at that time, they would be completely. I mean, that like an ethnic genocide. So that's why the West stronger. The West was not particularly interested to go in that country for several reasons. One is not particularly interesting for strategic reason. So Syria was completely abandoned for the first 2 years, and that's why I was very keen to go there and to write about the life of Syrians, because maybe I'm part Syrian. So the fact that now there is a huge interest, only because ISIS became the new cancer of the Middle East, I find it a bit I found it a little bit ridiculous. I mean, the Syrian situation is very bad, and now we are talking just about how ISIS is bad. But we have forgotten about the use of unconventional weapons during 4 years of war, and also the chemical weapons. So the situation is very complicated.
Gianni, to you, if I might. You just mentioned in passing multilateralism versus minilateralism. I would have thought that Syria's a classic case, or becoming a case where only minilateralism can be effective.
Indeed, and this is why for the last 3 years what we have, I've been writing this very unhumbly, but what is happening, in fact, as you know, even over the last 6 months, particularly more clearly for those who follow this that particular region, the step that will move the reality in Syria and in Iraq is, let's call it an understanding or some kind of getting together in some way between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They are the first line players of the region. Everything else comes second. If they don't really play together, in some way, which is, of course, absurd, because one is Shia, one is Sunni. But let me tell you, in the last 6 months, the unreported rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran has moved on gently, gently. And that is why, for instance, Maliki eventually went. Maliki was a former prime minister of Iraq, stepped down when a number of conversations between the Saudis and the Iranians took place, between the Shias, so to speak, the Shia mother country and the Sunni mother country. And that was the key why Maliki actually eventually left after many people tried to push him out.
We've got to wind it up. Gianni and Susan, I thank you both for your time. It's a huge topic and one which we shall have to keep revisiting. Juan Domenico Pico has been talking to me via Skype from Connecticut, co-author of The Fog of Peace, as well as author of The Man Without a Gun, The Secret Struggle to Free the Hostages, Fight Terrorism and End a War, detailing his work as a negotiator for the UN. Susan Dabou, who was taken captive last year in Syria, but was freed and has written a book of her experiences called How Would You Like to Die? The Diary of a Kidnapping in Syria. And she was talking via Skype from Jerusalem. And now, a health warning, we're about to talk dirty. And if many of you find this offensive, you might like to switch to a more congenial radio program. This particular one is LNL on RN. Over the past few years, the internet has brought down the axe on all the media that I worked for the last half century, but it's also brought down the axe on the pornographic film industry. And one of the advantages is that it seems to be a whole lot safer for women workers. So the world's oldest profession has not been left out of this period of transformation. Josie Delap is home affairs correspondent for The Economist, and she argues that the buying and selling of sex is now much easier and much safer thanks to the web. And Josie, like a remarkable number of guests for our little program, joins me from The Economist studio in London. And from the Melbourne studio is former sex worker and president of the Australian Sex Party, Fiona Patton. Fiona and her partner are both old friends of mine. He was my producer when I was doing breakfast at 2UE years ago. Fiona says that, that's Robbie Swan, I should name him. Fiona says that with so many online sites for prostitution, selling sex on the web can actually be a challenging or difficult task. Josie, you write that the internet, yes, has disrupted many industries. How has it affected the porn industry as we knew it, the era of deep throat?
The porn industry has been incredibly disrupted by the internet. It's hard to imagine why people continue to buy DVDs or magazines of pornography when so much is available online, and not only in terms of sort of sheer overall quantity, but also in a diversity of offerings online. People can really choose to indulge specialist interests very much. And so it's clear that pornography sort of as an idea as a whole has flourished on the internet, but the industry itself, the studios, the directors are struggling.
Now, let's look at the impact on prostitution, because you see it as well, being transformational and in many ways progressive.
Absolutely. I mean, there are positive and negative sides to this kind of transformation in any industry. And clearly it doesn't. The fact that more people are buying and selling sex online hasn't eliminated the harms that come with prostitution. But it has made it easier for sex workers. I mean, I say women because the data that we were looking at primarily addressed covered women, but obviously there are men as well who sell sex. But it has made it much easier for them to set themselves up as businesses, to develop brands, to really be able to distinguish themselves among a market of sellers where that's very hard to do, or has been very hard to do in the past. So you have, the sort of advantages of the business side, and then you also have increases in mechanisms to make people safer.
So the sex worker can what? Check out the customer by
absolutely. I mean, sex workers have always been very careful about, doing everything they can to ensure that their clients are not violent. There's a limit to what they can do. But I think that the internet has opened up a lot more avenues to do that. There are websites where clients can submit their information, whether that's credit card details, whether it's home addresses, social media identifiers, and the website, the third party website, will verify their identity and then give them a sort of, online business card or similar that they can then present to the sex worker to say, yes, I am who, I am a genuine person. You could track me back through this website. But the customer doesn't have to give their contact details directly to the sex worker, which some may be reluctant to do. And sex workers can share among themselves details of people who have either been abusive, who have refused to pay in the past, who have generally been troublesome clients, either sort of sharing that, through online forums, or there are specific schemes like the Ugly Mugs one in Britain that allows people to submit the telephone numbers or email addresses or descriptions of clients who have been abusive. And then when you get a new client, you put their number into the database and see if they pop up as somebody who's been a problem in the past for other people.
Fiona, I want to bring you into it now. Let's, if you'll forgive the pun, let's look at things down under. What's happening to the porn industry here? Because we did have an indigenous, a local porn industry, and what's happening to prostitution?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we probably, Josie's quite right. I mean, I'm not quite sure why people buy DVDs, but we've seen a decline of about 80% here. We used to sell about 13 million DVDs in Australia, even though it's illegal to sell them in every state. So we're still having police bust adult stores in Australia for selling DVDs when one hopes that they've heard of this thing called the internet. But yes, we've seen a real change there. And we've certainly seen our local industry kind of burgeon and emerge because of the internet and enabling them to actively pursue the international market far more easily than when they had to send over a video to somewhere in the Fortitude Valley of LA. But so it has. We've seen some positive changes.
Well, Fiona, let's go back to the other area which Josie's talking about, that it makes it able for a girl to successfully freelance. Is there an electronic version of the madam or the pimp?
Well, there is, and I probably see these kind of directory services set up, you know, new ones every week in Australia. I suppose we come, it's coming from a slightly different area because we've been legalising and regulating sex work over the years, since the 80s. And certainly in the 90s, we saw a big leap, of governments taking quite pragmatic decisions about decriminalising sex work here. So we've actually had legal brothels and legal organised sex work, which the UK and the US, where a lot of these figures are coming from, have never had. And so I guess a sex worker's approach to online is, yes, a lot of it is about branding, but for many sex workers, they have found a safe place to work within an organised offline situation.
Josie, I want to talk about the US in a minute, but just to clarify something, what's the legal situation for brothels, for prostitution in the UK?
Well, Britain has a very messy set of laws when it comes to prostitution. It is legal to buy and sell sex, but it's not legal to work in a brothel or to run a brothel. It's not legal to live off the earnings of someone else's prostitution. And it's also not legal to buy sex from somebody who has been trafficked, even if you don't know that they have been trafficked. So I think it's quite a confusing situation. And although, you know, selling sex itself is legal, the problem with, for example, making brothels illegal is that what that effectively means is that two women can't work together in a flat whereby, you know, one is seeing clients and the other is either looking after the phones or just, you know, providing some kind of security or backup for the person who's at work. And so it really, you know, it does very little to make sex workers' lives easier or safer.
But if you want hypocrisy or confusion on that absolute epic scale, you have to go to the US, which prostitution is illegal, except for God's sake, in Nevada.
Absolutely, and I mean in Nevada, it's a series. It's not throughout the state. It's in a number of areas where you have brothels, which are relatively isolated. They're hard both for clients and for sex workers to get to. They have to spend a lot of money to travel out to them to work in them. So that doesn't really provide much of a sort of optimal working
but it's like all forms of prohibition, Josie. It doesn't work. And you put the figure of the money spent on prostitution in the US at $14 billion per annum.
Absolutely. And I mean that's an old figure. There are very few reliable numbers to be found about any aspect of prostitution. But clearly, I'm sure it has gone up enormously since then. And as you say, you know, prohibition simply doesn't reduce demand, it just pushes things underground.
So what will happen as a result of this vast tectonic shift created by the internet? What will happen in the US? What is happening?
Well, it's sort of, authorities are obviously aware of this because they are increasingly pursuing people online through sites where sex workers advertise, where people review sex workers, where sex workers communicate with each other. And, you know, one prostitute said to me that now, you know, we don't spend our time worrying about finding clients online or being safe online. We're spending our time trying to avoid stings from the cops. And that, you know, again, that's not really sort of doing very much to improve their lives. But I think, I mean, what this inevitably means is it becomes much, much harder for the government to try and crack down on sex work. I mean, it's already very difficult. It's already an industry that happens in a lot of ways in quite discreet spaces, and this only makes it harder. So, you know, you would hope that at some point governments would realise that this is a fairly futile effort.
Fiona, I want to look at Sweden. It's a country where the sex laws are, to say the least, interesting, as a certain young man in the Ecuadorian embassy could attest. Tell us about the so-called Swedish model.
Yes, well, it's an interesting model. They've decided to say that sex work itself is legal or decriminalised, so it's quite legal to have sex with someone for money, but it's illegal to pay anyone for sex. So the client...
I'm sorry, would you run that past me?
That's right. So quite legal to have sex for money.
I'm just writing this in. It's
illegal to pay someone for sex.
Yes, well, that's perfectly clear.
And unfortunately, I mean, we're seeing this model being touted in Australia, where we've actually probably been very progressive in comparison to the rest of the world in recognising sex work as just that work.
Well, the Greens in Victoria are calling for the Swedish model to be introduced.
That's right. I mean, this may become an election issue in Victoria. A number of Greens members have called for the Swedish model in bed with the Australian Christian lobby. So sex work, the emotion of sex work does seem to create interesting bedfellows, as it were.
Stop making these terrible puns. They're worse than mine. Josie, you're of the opinion... Oh, first of all, is anyone contemplating the Swedish model in the UK, Josie?
Yes, I mean, there was an all-parliamentary group report on sex work earlier this year, which was sort of... I mean, the people on the committee are an interesting group of politicians who sort of combine a certain number of people with quite strong Christian leanings and some with quite strong feminist leanings, who are not obvious allies in a lot of things, but who have come together, not, you know, very much along the Swedish lines, to say that those selling sex are victims. They should not be prosecuted. They should be helped. But the people buying sex from them are criminals and should be locked up or fined.
I'm sorry, I interrupted. Keep going.
No. And I mean, there hasn't so far been, been a move to actually put this into law. But as Fiona said, you know, this is an idea that is gathering pace. Not just in Australia and Britain. People have talked about it in America. Canada is trying to push this through. The European Parliament voted, albeit on a non-binding motion, to say that this should be the model that European countries should follow. So it's certainly the model that is gathering momentum.
You've looked at 190,000 profiles of female prostitutes for the cover story in The Economist. Have you come to the view that sex workers are victims or not?
Well, it's very hard to talk about sex workers as a homogenous group. They are very diverse. The data that we looked at didn't really tell us whether these people had been exploited, whether they'd been forced into sex work. And clearly some people are. And that is an awful thing. And
well, at the moment you talk about price cutting because of girls coming in from Eastern Europe. Clearly, you know, in trouble.
Well, it's not clear that everybody coming in from Eastern Europe has been trafficked. I mean, there is a difference between migration, legal or illegal, doing that in order to sell sex because you have decided that that is the way that you can make the most money. I think there are clearly, having talked to a number of sex workers, there are clearly a large number who do, as Fiona says, who think of this as work. It's not, some very much enjoy it. Some enjoy it some of the time. But, you know, we don't require other professions to enjoy their work every minute of every day in order for it to be justifiable for them to do it.
If we applied that to journalism, it would make it very
well,
tough,
indeed,
wouldn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah.
I think it is. There are a huge range of people involved in this for a very wide variety of reasons. And what is clear is that even those who end up selling sex for the worst reasons, because they're either forced into it or because they really, you know, they have no other choices and feel that this is not what they want to do, but that they must, even they are not helped by criminalizing it. So, the argument that this should be illegal because that helps get people who don't want to be in this industry out of it, I think is a weak one.
Fiona, I've heard you argue in the past that there are more educated women working in the sex industry today, and some people come into it for a while, make a bit of money, you know, and then leave it. Is it easier for them to do so because of the internet?
Look, I think the internet has certainly changed things, and it may have educated more people about sex work, and being able to run your own business online. Also, probably in Australia, they might do that in conjunction with a brothel or with an escort agency. So it enables you to have more agency on how you promote yourself and how you use yourself. I mean, the interesting thing in Australia, though, with the internet is that because many of our laws around sex work were set up prior to the internet, and because of Australia's record at being so pathetically bad about internet regulation, technically it's illegal for a Victorian sex worker to use the internet to advertise. And if she does use it, she can only show her face, which basically is probably not the body part that most sex workers want to promote their
business
with.
Well, you'll have to talk to Malcolm Turnbull and sort that out.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, in actual fact, technically, you know, because we're not allowed to have adult websites hosted in Australia, probably half the sites are technically illegal here anyway.
Fiona, I have to echo or re-ask the question I put to Josie. Mm. To what extent are women making the choice to work in the industry as sex workers freely as opposed to being exploited?
I would say the vast, vast majority, and even those sex workers that come from other countries to work here, where it is quite difficult to enter the, to come to our country legally to work as a sex worker. So some of those workers end up getting caught up working in unregulated brothels or for unregulated agencies. And that makes, I guess, the ability to exploit them more easy. But that goes back to the fact that we don't let these sex workers come into our country and work legally under, you know, proper visas. And that would assist in exploitation far more than any form of criminalisation would.
Josie, I like your reaction to author Melissa Grant, who writes in her book that for prostitutes, the internet fulfills many of the functions of a workplace, you know, online forums replacing the office water cooler.
Yes, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, honestly. I mean, to look through the discussions that people have online, in part because I think it really does so much to dispel the myth, you know, as Fiona said, that everybody is exploited or trafficked. And just, you know, the kind of very quotidian concerns that people have about how best to go about their business, the tiresomeness of having to shave your legs every day, the, you know, which sheets stand up to washing best, which, you know.
Look, on that technical note, we shall take our leave. Look, Josie and Fiona, thank you very much for your time. Josie de Lapitz, Home Affairs Correspondent at The Economist. Fiona Patten, President of the Australian Sex Party and founder of the Eros Foundation. On our next, David Maher, who's an absolute libertarian on matters sexual, will be talking about the state of free speech in Australia. And we'll also have Bea Campbell on a very serious issue of the Irish abortion controversy. That's pretty much the lot. I will talk to you in 23 hours.
The Science Show will be 39 this week, but I'm not sure you should listen to our 39th birthday programme after all. Consider, I interview a man at length who can't speak. Then we learn about an adventure 102 years ago that ended in death and disappointment. And finally, we hear from a forester aged 90. So why listen? Well, I think you'll be surprised. And you can download the 39th birthday programme by going to the RN website.